Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. After the country picked its jaws off the ground when Donald Trump was elected president in 2016, everyone went looking for reasons behind the upset. One factor that was studied was the so-called Comey effect. Less than 2 weeks before Election Day, FBI Director James Comey disclosed the Bureau was reviewing new emails from Hillary Clinton's time as Secretary of State. It brought a cloud over Clinton's campaign, but ultimately, 2 days before the election, Comey announced there was nothing in that new investigation that would warrant charges. Pundits still debate whether Comey's actions cost Clinton the election, and Comey says he's still mildly ill about that possibility. But all of that pales in comparison to what happened as the result of President Trump firing James Comey as head of the FBI. It led directly to the appointment of Robert Mueller as special counsel to probe Russian interference in the 2016 election and any connection the president or his campaign had to that meddling. The firing also took the muzzle off James Comey. He calls the president unethical and untethered to the truth, and he has called on voters to oust the president in 2020. Comey gave his side of the story about his firing and his concerns about the president in his best-selling book, A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership. Next Tuesday night, Mr. Comey is coming to speak at the Belk Theater in an event hosted by Queen's University of Charlotte's Learning Society. And this hour, we listen back to our conversation from February. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
In the time since you first met Mr. Trump and today, have your concerns diminished, gotten worse, or stayed the same?
They've deepened in most respects and stayed the same in one respect. What I mean is my concerns about the president's moral actions, his behavior as a human being in terms of his constant lying, and his attacks on the rule of law, my concerns about those things have only deepened. The one respect in which it's either the same or maybe even a little bit less concerned is he's less effective at actually obstructing the rule of law than I feared he might be. It's really bad that he attacks our institutions of justice and our courts, but he's not actually stopped the machine of justice from trying to find the truth, and that makes me feel better, should make all Americans feel better.
As FBI director, you were privy to information that the general public has no access to. You also had firsthand knowledge of the inner workings of the FBI and of the Justice Department. Has that given you a unique perspective on events as they've unfolded since your firing, or are you as in the dark as many of us are about what's going to happen next and what's happening behind the scenes?
Probably a little bit of both. First of all, I don't know where the special counsel is in particular. I have no idea what he's going to conclude with respect to the president. I have maybe a deeper understanding and appreciation for how the justice system works and of the nature and quality of the people in it than the public may have. I worry a little bit that people who don't know the institution well enough may believe the president's lies, and that's a problem.
Does it puzzle you? Obviously, it must trouble you, but does it puzzle you that those who have traditionally stood up for the Justice Department, stood up for the FBI, stood up for the rule of law, have not taken a more active role in combating the impression, the negative impression about those institutions that the president may be giving certain parts of our society?
Yes, it puzzles me, and it actually troubles me a great deal. I was a Republican nearly all of my adult life, and for the life of me, I can't understand how people who are still Republicans reconcile their silence with what they've said as Republicans their entire life about things like character, that character is destiny, that the truth matters, that the rule of law and our institutions have to be at the center of our public life. I don't know how they square silence in the face of a president savagely attacking and lying about those things with their professed commitment to those values. I just can't understand it. That's not a political statement, I hope. That's a values statement. And I don't understand how they're going to explain it to their grandchildren.
I believe I'm correct in saying that this is the first time in our history that any former director of the FBI, not to mention two former directors of the FBI, have released books and gone on speaking tours in which they were astonishingly critical of the sitting president of the United States. This must be unprecedented, and it can't merely be coincidental. Would that be accurate? I mean, we have Andrew McCabe and you.
Yeah, I think in the main, it is unprecedented. Louis Free, who was director during the Bush administration, first Bush and then Clinton, and left under Clinton, wrote a book afterwards and was very critical of President Clinton and spoke about it. But yeah, despite that, there's never been a time like this. And I've wrestled with my role. I don't know whether I'm doing it right, but I decided I would be a coward to do what I would actually prefer to do, which is to go away and not be known in airports, not be seen. But when I see things that I care about a lot, what should I do? I think the answer is I got to speak out. And I think Andy McCabe feels a lot of the same pressure, that when your values are under attack, again, this isn't a policy judgment, when your values are under attack, silence is cowardice.
These disagreements that the both of you have with the president are not, as you say, on policy. They are on what he is doing publicly and what he may or may not be doing behind the scenes. How often do you question, however, that you might be overreacting?
Oh, I try and ask myself that all the time, right? You're incompetent if you can't convince yourself of your own righteousness, and so there's a danger, of course, that I'm overreacting or that I'm convincing myself of things, and so I really do try to read criticism, to demand feedback from people. And I may not have it perfectly right, but I think on balance, I'm right to be concerned deeply about our values. The only thing we have in common is a set of values. We hold truths. And you know, we always hold them imperfectly. We're never quite as good as our values, but we hold values. Truth foremost among those values. And above our policy differences, we all agree on those things. And so what I hope to do, the reason I'm coming to Charlotte to speak is, I need to be part of a conversation where we lift our eyes above the things that normally divide us and stare at the thing that is the essence of America, our values. Our president must reflect our values. You cannot have a chronic liar as president of the United States, someone who attacks the rule of law. I don't care how much you like his judicial picks. I don't care how much you like his views on policy. You must look first at our values. And one of the reasons I am no longer a Republican is I can't explain how the Republican Party reconciles its words about values with its silence today.
I would think it's because the values that he espouses are values that at least a third of the country, 34% of the country or something like that, believes in, and that's certainly the core of the Republican base and certainly the core of his base. What does that say to you about the country?
Yeah, I don't believe that, though. I don't demonize people who voted for Donald Trump or who support Donald Trump. I just don't think that they're weighing things in the right way. I don't think that they're lifting their eyes above their passion about immigration or their passion about regulation and staring at what it is that we have in common, which is our values, which are non-negotiable. You know, so many of the people who've supported Donald Trump come from military families with a long record of sacrificing for this country. Those people didn't sacrifice for a tax cut or a wall or a particular approach to immigration or climate change. They sacrificed, and in many cases lost their lives, for a set of values. They held them dearer than anything else, including their own lives. They sacrificed themselves for freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of opportunity, the truth, the rule of law, the things that make us uniquely American. And so I actually don't think that the folks who support Donald Trump have a different view of it than I do. I just don't think they're focusing on those first, which is where they have to start. And then we'll get to the important things that divide us.
When did you first meet Donald Trump?
Friday, January the 6th of 2017, when I went to Trump Tower with the leaders of the CIA, the NSA, and the Director of National Intelligence.
What was your first impression?
I was concerned, almost felt a bit of a vertigo type experience, because I was struck that they hadn't asked any questions about how they, as the incoming leadership team of the United States, might protect America going forward. I was struck that all of their focus was backward looking. What could be said to minimize this when you're about to become the steward of American security. That concerned me. And I was concerned and struck and disturbed by my sense of the leadership culture around Donald Trump. And it was so dramatic, my reaction, that I thought it was an overreaction, and so I kept trying to push it away. But I was really struck by how much it reminded me of the leadership culture around a mob boss. I mean that in an organized crime family, it's all about the boss, only the boss, what will serve the boss. And I had that reaction in the moment, and then obviously my reaction was increased by additional encounters. So I was thrown by both of those things, their lack of focus on protecting the country, and second, this leadership culture.
Former FBI Director James Comey is our guest this hour. He's speaking Tuesday night at the Belk Theater in a sold-out event hosted by Queen's University of Charlotte's Learning Society. More of our conversation after this break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're listening this hour to our February conversation with former FBI Director James Comey, author of the bestseller A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership. He'll be in Charlotte on Tuesday night speaking to Queen's University of Charlotte's Learning Society. We just talked about the first time you met Donald Trump in Trump Tower just prior to Inauguration Day and the troubling thoughts that you had about the culture that he surrounded himself which reminded you of a mob boss. Andrew McCabe has described the president's leadership style the same way you just did, resembling that of an organized crime syndicate. And you describe the president's style in your book this way. You write, "The silent circle of assent, the boss in complete control, the loyalty oaths, the us versus them worldview, the lying about all things large and small in service to some code of loyalty that put the organization above morality and above the truth." I'm particularly interested in that last part of that sentence, the lying about all things large and small. Do you think he knows he's doing it?
Certainly, in some cases. I would imagine it's a mix of things he knows he's making false statements about, things that he's mistaken about, which is a normal human experience, and things he just doesn't care whether they're true or false. I would imagine it's a collection of all of those, but certainly there's a variety of things that he knows are false.
In your book, you say you reserve judgment on whether the president's actions at the time he asked you about Michael Flynn and other times since constituted obstruction of justice. And you say that I have one perspective on the behavior I saw, which while disturbing and violating basic norms of ethical leadership, may fall short of being illegal. Do you believe that was due to the experience and skill of the president in skirting the law born out of his business dealings, or because Donald Trump is willing to go right up to the line without crossing it, relying on bullying and intimidation to get what he wants done?
I don't know. I don't know what it is exactly. And it could be something, though, to be fair to him, that he had something else in his head when he, I'm making this up, but let's imagine that he was worried about Mike Flynn's family, and that was all he was thinking about, and not thinking that I'm doing something improper in this request. It's a humanitarian request. Now, what cuts the other way is, if you're going to make a humanitarian request, why do you kick everybody out of the room, including the FBI director's boss? But I don't know for sure.
You've said that his leadership is transactional, it's ego-driven, it's about personal loyalty with essentially no respect for institutional values. Talk about the unethical nature of his character. Give us some specific examples, aside from the fact that you feel that he told you to stop the Flynn investigation, you stop going after Michael Flynn. What are some of the unethical attributes that you see, that you saw behind the scenes and that we can see in full view every day?
The most important is the absence of external reference points in making decisions. An ethical leader, at least to my mind, is not defined by the decisions you make. Everybody can disagree about a decision. It's about how you made the decisions and what were the reference points you looked to. And ethical leaders have some sort of framework. They'll look to history or logic or norms or faith or philosophy. They look to something externally to help them make decisions. And obviously a leader of the United States should look to our Constitution and our values. And I don't see any of that with this president. My judgment is he has one reference point, and it's internal. How do I fill this tremendous hole in me, this craving for affirmation, which is unlike anything I've ever seen in an adult? And I know that sounds like hyperbole, but I don't mean it to be. I've never seen an adult with a greater craving for affirmation. And so a leader with no external reference points, with only a reference point that is internal, my need for affirmation, is by definition unethical, because you won't be thinking about any of the values that should guide your decisions in making your decisions. And you see that in action when you see someone who's lying so often. And I worry that ears who are supportive of the president will shut down when they hear this. But even if you support the man, you have to agree he lies constantly. And maybe you think that's okay, but he lies constantly. That is the manifestation of someone who lacks external reference points, who just believes, I need to say whatever I need to say to get me something that will fill this hole in me. And that is dangerous in a leader of any kind, but especially in one entrusted with the responsibilities of President of the United States.
If you're being generous, you can say that the president likes to shake things up, and that explains his unconventional approach. Others, such as yourself, have said that he has no respect for institutional values, nor respect for many of the institutions that have sustained this nation for much of its history. Is that out of ignorance? Is it out of inexperience? Does he understand? He clearly doesn't understand how the government works, but is that because of a lack of education in that area, or because he's run a small business all of his life and never had any experience with government, being in the government? The Trump Organization is not a conglomerate. It's a ma-and-pa company. He's now running the biggest organization in the world. Is it because of venality and some sense of need to cover one's tracks? What is it?
Not easy to answer. All humans are complex, and Donald Trump seems as complex as any. That there's no doubt that he doesn't understand how the government works, and that, to my mind, is a consolation. It's a blessing, because he's not able to be effective in accomplishing the goals he sets out. He talks a big game, but doesn't get much done. That's a good thing in a lot of ways. He's talked about obstructing justice and burning down the FBI and the Department of Justice, and he's been unable to accomplish his goal because he's not competent enough to do that, and so that's a good thing. As to what makes up the rest of the picture, it's hard for me to say. There's no doubt that he knows a number of the things he is saying are untrue, a large number, so that's a lie, intentional, knowing lie. And he knows that a variety of things he's done are inconsistent with America's values, and he doesn't care because those values are not part of his frame of reference. It's all about filling that hole that's internal to him.
Now, I remember growing up being taught these American values and believing these American values and believing that our government did the right thing. I think that was probably a very naive grade school impression of the country, because we have done some not so nice things over the course of our history. But then Ronald Reagan comes along and he says government is the problem. And you have Grover Norquist, who wants to shrink government to the size that it can be put into a teacup. Is this the natural progression of that, to have a president come to power, voted into office by people who want him to take down the government, to make it something other than what it has been?
I don't know. I would actually put it into a broader frame, that this is part of the normal jagged line of American history, that we've always had fights about the size of government. And think about how vicious the fights were about FDR's plans in the 1930s. And so those have always been part of our history. Here's how I think about it. Our line, if you graft our progress against our values, is always upward sloping. It's not perfect, right? We were born in original sin. We held truth to be self-evident while we held human beings as slaves. But our progress against our espoused values is always upward. But if you stare at it closely, it's actually not a solid line. It's a jagged line. This country, we make progress, there's great change, and then there's retrenchment. And then there's progress, change, retrenchment. It just goes on and on. Mm-hmm. Always upward sloping at the end. I see this as another one of those. People forget our history. I console people by saying we have been so much more screwed up in our history than this. in 1919, women got the vote. After World War I, African Americans moved into new roles in America. Jews, Catholics, immigrants of all kinds flowed in, and in the 1920s, the KKK was reborn. 20-some million Americans joined it. One-third of the members of our Congress joined the KKK. That's a jagged down. And then that fever broke in the late 20s, and we resumed our upward march. That's our picture. And so we've experienced tremendous change. We elected a black guy, for heaven's sakes. Right? We have totally new approaches to work, to family, to faith, to community. We're on our way to become the white majority becoming a plurality in this country. That challenges us, and it's really predictable. We'd have a downward jag, and then we'll resume our upward progress again. So I put this in that context. We can shorten the time before we return to our progress by speaking about our values, by not remaining silent in the face of demagoguery. But make no mistake about it, we will resume our upward climb because that's the story of America.
And that what you just talked about, the fear and the globalization, et cetera, and the rise in populism that we seem to have a battle with, on-again, off-again battle with, can be explained away by that upward trajectory of history. But this is the first time, I think, we've ever had a president who has taken the word of a foreign leader over that of his own security establishment. The first time we've had a president dispute, at least publicly, our security apparatus and what they've said about places like North Korea and other governments. This president has attacked the Justice Department and individuals in the Justice Department. He's taken unconventional positions on NATO and U.S. operations in Syria. Do you view these things as deliberate attempts to tear down institutions that have stood the test of time, or merely following through on his campaign promises to drain the swamp, to change how things get done?
I think it's a combination of those things. Some of it is simply ignorance. Some of it is an intention driven of tremendous self-interest. Right? So his attacks on the rule of law are all about what will protect him. He doesn't care about the institutions.
Because a lot of people who say he's tearing down the institutions say there must be a reason why he's doing this, and maybe he's doing this at the behest of someone else, like Vladimir Putin. Are you in that camp?
No, because I don't know. There's definitely something that is very hard to explain about the president's attitude towards Vladimir Putin. And what I mean by that is, there's plenty of reasons why on a global stage a president of the United States might not want to call out a foreign leader because there's a strategic chess game going on of some sort. But I found that even in private, President Trump would not criticize Vladimir Putin, and that makes no sense at all to me. And so I don't know what it is, but there's something very, very odd about some of the things you mentioned, throwing the U.S. intelligence community under the bus while standing next to Vladimir Putin. To my mind, that's unconscionable. But even in private, he won't criticize Vladimir Putin, and I don't know why, but we can't stop asking why.
So do you believe that the criticisms of policy and personnel within the Justice Department, within the military, within the CIA, at the FBI, are actually weakening those institutions and their ability to work effectively, or are they merely puzzling to both allies and enemies? And worse, is it really hurting morale within these institutions, which I have heard talked about, because these people are smart people. They're professionals. They've been there for a long time. Why would their morale be affected by some guy taking them to task when a lot of what he says simply isn't true and they know it?
Well, it hurts their effectiveness, and it does hurt their morale, but not in the long run. The short-term impact is, look, when the president of the United States says something, there's a lot of people who believe that, who take that as true on face value. It's the president of the United States saying the FBI is corrupt, or the intelligence community are Nazis, or the FBI is stormtroopers. And so those things are lies, but a lot of people believe them. And so two things happen. The FBI, to take one I know really well, must be trusted and believed at street corner conversations and in courtrooms. And if good people who don't know better and who are good enough to believe the President of the United States start to doubt them, their ability to recruit witnesses, to be believed in court is affected. their effectiveness declines, and we're less safe. One. Two, when the President of the United States is lying about your institution constantly, and your neighbors, some of them, are believing it, that affects your morale because you end up having to defend this institution against these lies, and it becomes exhausting and overwhelming. So there is an impact to effectiveness and morale in the short run. The good news is no president, including this president, serves long enough to screw up the central culture of the United States military, the intelligence community, or the FBI. It's just there is no deep state, but there are deep values in those institutions, commitment to the truth and the rule of law being the most prominent. He cannot screw that up. And so if he were going to be president for 25 or 30 or 40 years, I'd be worried. But those institutions are strong enough, resilient enough, that in the long run, they will be fine. Our job, my job, one of the reasons I'm speaking to you right now is to participate in a conversation to try and reduce the short-term damage, to call it out, to speak truth into a storm of lies, to try and protect the effectiveness and the morale of those people.
Our conversation with former FBI Director James Comey continues in a moment, right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Back to our February conversation with James Comey, the former FBI director and author of A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership, the 2018 bestseller in which he details his concerns about President Trump and his administration. Queen's University of Charlotte is bringing Mr. Comey to Charlotte on Tuesday for a sold-out Learning Society event at the Belk Theater. All the things that we've talked about, some people would say that you have nobody to blame but yourself because of your approach to Hillary Clinton and her emails. You said that your decision to announce the fact that the FBI was opening an investigation into additional emails 11 days before the election, only to come back 2 days before Election Day and say there was nothing new and nothing to prosecute, may have cost her the election. And Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, just said a couple of days ago that the Justice Department should not reveal information about people who are investigated unless they're prepared to bring an indictment. What happened with Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, first of all, that's a totally reasonable question. And I would hope that two things would happen. People who have that question will take the time to stare at the decisions, the choices that we faced in October. And second, stare at it, understanding that it's just not true that the Department of Justice always refuses to be transparent in the absence of criminal charges. Yeah, the policy is you normally don't speak unless charges are brought, except the policy contains this exception where there is exceptional public interest. The general rule makes sense, but there are times when the American public needs to be reassured that the work was done well and fairly, even if that involves talking about the conduct of uncharged parties.
But wasn't the FBI also investigating Russian connections or Russian attempts to interfere in the election and their possible connection to the Trump campaign, even as you were investigating Hillary Clinton's emails?
Yes, totally reasonable question as well.
So why not bring that up at the same time you brought up the Hillary Clinton thing?
The Hillary Clinton case began with a public referral to the FBI. And even though that had happened in 2015, we still refused to talk about it for months. We finally confirmed we had an investigation underway, and then we didn't speak about it again until the investigation was done in July of 2016. The FBI's counterintelligence investigation into trying to figure out whether any Americans were helping the Russians began in late July of 2016, and we actually never even considered making a public disclosure, again, because of the way we approached the Clinton case and because we didn't know whether we had anything. We literally just had smoke in the summer of 2016, so I'm sure it didn't come up because we wouldn't even know what to say at that point. But in late October, the problem there was we had told the world, not just I, but the Attorney General had as well, we're done with this Clinton business. Move on. You can trust us. This was done well. Go away. In the face of brutal assaults from the Republicans, we stood our ground. In late October, it turns out that's not true anymore, and in a way that may actually change the result. So what do you do then? You've told the American people this is over, you offer transparency, now you know that's a lie, is one way to think about it. So do you tell Congress it's no longer true, or do you stay silent, which would be, in my view, concealment? Those are both terrible options. Which one you choose depends upon the harm you think flows from them. I thought, I can't possibly conceal from Congress and the American people that what we told them is no longer true. I have to speak the truth, having testified under oath repeatedly about this. But reasonable people might see it differently. I thought, it'll be really bad to speak. It would be catastrophic to conceal that fact from the American people. And so that's why I chose the first door and not the second door.
So the Robert Mueller investigation has indicted many of the inner circle in the Trump campaign, from campaign manager Paul Manafort to Trump's personal lawyer Michael Cohen to many, many, many others. And many of the people caught up in those indictments appear to have had a lot of contacts with Russians. As a former prosecutor, as the former director of the FBI, what does it tell you that so many of the Trump campaign's inner circle and the Trump administration's inner circle have been indicted?
There are a lot of crooks and liars close to this president.
And what does that tell you about the man?
Well, it doesn't surprise me, given the nature, again, as we talked about at the beginning, given the nature of his leadership, that kind of leadership does not attract great people. It takes the kind of leadership that attracts great people is leadership where the leader is comfortable enough in his or her own skin to take joy in their underlings, to launch them, to advance them, to support them. The antithesis of that is leadership that's focused on what do you bring me, the boss. That kind of leadership does not attract great talent, that second kind.
I know that this calls for speculation, but if you surround yourself with corrupt individuals, people who have been indicted and sentenced to prison, and people who are continually under investigation, if you surround yourself with those kinds of people, is it conceivable, is it even possible that you yourself are innocent of any criminal or illegal activity?
Yeah, too hard for me to answer in the abstract. Look, anything's possible, but I can't handicap it here. So I don't want to answer the hypothetical.
Okay. Following your firing, acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe ordered counterintelligence and obstruction probes of the president. He told George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week that doing so was a national security imperative. Did you know that the Bureau had opened those probes at the time after you'd left?
No.
Do you agree with Andrew McCabe's assessment that opening those probes were a national security imperative?
I don't know. I don't have enough information to know one way or the other because I wasn't part of those conversations. I gather from what I've seen him saying in the media is that they were really hard conversations, and I bet they were because they had to think about the law, the policy, the facts. And so I can't render a judgment from this distance.
Had you considered doing anything like that? You took you thought enough of your meetings with the president and were fearful enough of them to have taken contemporaneous notes to document those meetings. Did you ever consider doing something like that?
Sure. With respect to obstruction, I knew that our conversation that we had on Valentine's Day about the Flynn investigation was potentially obstruction of justice by the president, and that we were going to have to figure out how to deal with it, how to investigate it, how to look at it. But I did two things. I was most concerned that direction not get to the investigative team and chill them, and I needed guidance from the Department of Justice, which hadn't sorted out. So how are they going to lead this entire thing? And so I told the team, let's just hold on to it and then figure out, once Justice tells us how they're going to investigate, how we should approach this. And so I didn't open an investigation, but we kind of pressed the pause button to be able to sort it out once we had clear leadership guidance, and then I got fired.
Was the Trump Organization or the Trump Foundation or any of the activities surrounding Donald Trump on the FBI's radar at any time that you know of in the past?
I can't answer that, and please don't read too much into it, but I can't answer questions about whether we did or didn't have particular investigations.
Because that's secret information, and you would be in violation.
Yep. I still have to abide my FBI restrictions.
Okay. You and the president have traded more than a few barbs. You said that he is unfit to hold the office of president, that he's morally incompetent. You said that he has said of you that you are a proven leaker and liar and an untruthful slime ball, words that I never thought I would hear a president utter. We are so divided that people in the president's camp will never believe you, and those against the president will never believe him. How do we reach those in the middle?
By, first of all, not demonizing anyone. And second, by trying to center the conversation on the things I try to talk about, which are values, that this isn't about politics in the way we normally think about those things, that this is about something more important first. And second, once you've taken the temperature down in that way, just asking reasonable questions about the facts. For example, if I'm lying about what the president said to me on February the 14th, I must be insane, because not only did I write it down right afterwards and tell the FBI staff, but I testified under oath in public session before the United States Senate on June the 8th, 2017, at a time when the president's tweets had raised the prospect that there were tapes of those same conversations. So think about that. Who would go on national television and commit perjury in the face of tapes that would show him to be a liar? Nobody would. I mean, maybe people think I'm crazy. I'm not a crazy person. What I am is someone who is trying to truthfully recount what happened. And if you take the time to look at it that way, once the temperatures come down a little bit, I hope folks will see that the tweet storm of slurs just doesn't make any sense.
The news media has been breathless in their coverage of all of this back and forth. But as you travel around the country, do you get the impression that people are paying attention? Do they care?
There's a selection bias risk here, because I speak at universities and public speaking events like the one I'm going to do in Charlotte, where people who are very interested in public affairs come. And so I don't know. I think more and more they are. If I imagine our great country, I think of us as a bell curve. The wings are where the wing nuts are. We tend to hear from them most often. The middle is a great lump, a giant. And every so often in American history, the giant stirs, and it tends to be the thing that leads to an upward jag in our progress. And to take one from my lifetime, the giant stirred when little girls were killed at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham and children were bit by dogs and blown by fire hoses. The giant stirred. And then we, on a bipartisan basis, changed our country by passing the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. I feel the giant stirring again. I think you saw the giant starting to awaken in 2018. And if I can do anything, I want to wake the giant up to realize the threat to our values above any political policy disagreements we might have. And so there's a risk I'm talking myself into this, but as I travel around the country, I see young people, I see military veterans, I see people of all stripes saying, you know what, enough with the lying, enough with the attacks on our institutions and the rule of law. That's the giant stirring, which is always something that protects this country.
Well, you said we have to use every breath we have to make sure the lies stop on January 20th, 2021. That's Inauguration Day. You've also said the Democrats have to win. You're a Republican. Is that statement only in force if Donald Trump is the candidate?
Well, I don't know. It would depend on who the candidate is. It's hard to imagine someone who's a more dire threat to our values than Donald Trump. It's focused on Donald Trump as a candidate. Donald Trump, again, this isn't a comment about taxes or immigration or any of that. I have views on that, but I don't want to talk about it. I want to talk about values. The president must reflect the core values of the United States, cannot be a chronic liar who constantly attacks the rule of law. And that should be true no matter what your political affiliation. That has to be settled and restored. Then we'll go back to the important disagreements that are always part of our public life. But values are not negotiable.
I have 15 seconds left. What should happen to the Mueller report? Should it be released?
I don't know. I would hope that there'll be transparency. It's consistent with Department of Justice policy in some form or fashion, because the American people need to be assured of what I believe to be true. This work is being done well and fairly.
James Comey, former director of the FBI, author of A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership. Thank you so much for the hour.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.